Keep in touch with the Wolf Connection podcast on our Instagram handle at the Wolf Connection Pod, or email us your questions, comments, and guest ideas to podcast@wolfconnection.org. Thank you for your support, and howls to you all. Welcome to the Wolf Connection podcast. I'm your host, John Calvin. So a podcast for Stephen and I that might be a little bit on the lighter side, although we are going to be touching on conservation and coexistence issues, but in a different format. So we met this individual at the Yellowstone Wolf Summit, which was hosted by Wolves of the Rockies. And since that point, we've been in communication. There are some very exciting publications coming out in a different format. So children's books, but they also branch over into the conservation side, and really excited to have from Idaho Falls, Sylvia Medina. Sylvia, it's great to have you. She's the president of Green Kids Club, and we'll get into everything about that. First and foremost, how are you doing today?
Good. How are you doing?
Good. Just lots going on, as you know. Life takes us in many different directions, but we want to get a background here, because just before we recorded, you were saying that Green Kids Club been around, you know, fairly new, 6-7 years, but really have hit your stride in the series that you gave Stephen and I, a lot of those books that you've published in the last 2 to 3 years or 3 to 4 years. Where did you grow up? Where did this passion for environment, animals, all this stuff really begin to eventually form Green Kids Club?
Well, I grew up in Flagstaff, Arizona. So I've been always kind of lived in the mountainous areas, and, you know, grew up loving the environment and going hiking and doing all those great things. I, you know, my dad was a land surveyor, and he would take me out land surveying. So I would be outside all the time. And he's an engineer, and I became an environmental engineer because of my dad. So there's the technical part of being not just an environmental conservationist, but an environmental engineer. When I got my degree, I moved over to from New Mexico, where I went to college, to Idaho Falls. And Idaho Falls is, as many people know, is located very close to Teton National Park and Yellowstone National Park. And, you know, I started going over there to see what was, you know, I didn't know much about either park. But I always, when I grew up, I always loved animals, loved dogs, and, you know, chickens and turkeys and ducks and all sorts of animals when I grew up. And, you know, I just went out to the area, and I discovered grizzly bears. I discovered that there weren't many bears there. And actually, when I moved to Idaho Falls, I came to work for the Department of Energy Laboratory here. And so I'm considered what they call a lab rat here. So, you know, when you look at the movies that was based in Los Alamos, you know, that's kind of, we dealt with all the waste that was coming off of some of those projects. So I just really loved the environment, loved the animals, and, you know, really started learning about endangered species. And I became involved with the Greater Yellowstone Coalition, and actually, you know, just kind of put together some documents for them and learned about the gold mine that was going in at the time. And so that was really an exciting time for me, just to kind of learn about that. And then while in Idaho Falls, the other animal love I have is, you know, saving dogs and cats. And there was no animal shelter here in the area. And so at the time, they were euthanizing about 10,000 animals per year here in the location. And I was doing some work for the Humane Society. And eventually, later on, I actually am I'm now the founder of the Snake River Animal Shelter. I was able to raise enough money and, you know, get some land given to me by the city to actually have a shelter here. And so the euthanization has went away. But so the love of animals isn't just for, you know, the wild animals, but also the ones that we get to deal with every day. So that's kind of some of the early projects, you know, I did, you know, and so that's a little bit of my background.
Wow. That's cool.
That's pretty intense. That's pretty wild that you're able to start, you know, start a shelter there. And I didn't realize there were that many euthanizations.
That's a lot.
Happening. That's a lot. Meaning there's a lot of animals obviously running around without a home. My goodness. So go into then obviously pairing this passion of rescue and, you know, helping all walks of life here into Green Kids Club, because this, like you said, fairly new, under 10 years old, meaning, you know, so hasn't been around for a decade, but really seems to have an incredible impact on a lot of different sets of animals across different organizations. So what's really the mission when you started this whole thing and you had sort of the storyboard in your mind? What was your ultimate vision for Green Kids Club and how you wanted to see it play out? And has it played out that way in the last 6 or 7 years for you?
Well, when I started Green Kids Club itself, actually, I ended up owning a company called Northwind. It's an engineering company. And what we did was environmental cleanup all over the country. And I did that for about 14, 15 years. So during that period of time, I quit doing some of the conservation work because I had a business. And it was really pretty exciting time. You know, we actually did a lot of environmental type work where we would go out and, you know, track walruses in Alaska. And I mean, it was kind of a lot of work for the Department of Interior. So we did some really fun work, but we also did some work for the site here. And eventually I sold that business. And then during that period of time, you know, I had children, I had twins, and that's basically the reason I decided to sell the business, because I was just flying too much. And, you know, I kind of, you know, I love animals, and I was looking at my children one night, and I thought, you know, it'd be great to teach my children the importance of environmental stewardship and teach them how important it is to just protect our world and protect the animals in it. So I developed the concept in my mind of about three little kids that were mine, and they're the Green Kids. And actually to just kind of like come up with some ideas on different storylines on how they can save the planet. And realizing now, at the time, you know, I'm an environmental engineer, you know, and so I wasn't very good at writing anything other than a technical document, you know, about transuranic waste or something, you know, and radionuclides and blah, 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 you know. And right. So, you know, I decided to start writing these books. And to be honest with you, I did a pretty lousy job. You know, I didn't really know what I was doing. I wrote these stories. They came out all right. And they were about my kids, you know, who are environmental kids. And I was going to read them to my kids and maybe make an animation. That was my whole plan. And I didn't do a good job. And, you know, also, you know, I didn't realize, you know, the storyboarding. I didn't realize, you know, what goes into it. Our art did need some help. You know, I didn't realize that we had issues with our art. So, but I kept going, I kept working on it. And then, you know, in the meantime, you know, I started bugging some people online. I'm really good at that, you know? So I was, you know, I started bugging this woman from Elephants Without Borders, and she's the co-founder of that organization. And they're a big organization. And I said, hey, you want to write a children's book? And she's like, sure. She sent me back a note from Botswana. And I was like, oh my God, you know, she's responding. So we wrote this children's book, and, you know, it wasn't too bad, you know, but, you know, it was still far from what it should be, you know? And so then she contacts me and says, hey, you want to come to Botswana and see what we're doing? And I said, sure. So I flew out there, never really been to Africa. And I get flown out to, you know, the camp where they're out in the middle of the Okavango Delta. And I don't know if you know that much about Botswana, but, and out there, when I got there, there was, she was there, they had their campsite. And actually in the meantime, they've done some movies, are fairly famous. They tracked all the elephants in all of Africa, minus a couple of countries. They actually went and counted them. And so I get out there, and there's a baby elephant that somebody brought in, and probably maybe 2 months old, and it was really burned up. And what happened was they believed that some poachers had started a fire, and the whole herd took off, and the baby was left behind. So I ended up out in the Okavango Delta with Elephants Without Borders, with Kelly and Mike and the group, and they're trying to save this baby elephant. And I'm just sitting there watching this whole thing, you know, and I grew up raising calves, so I know how to raise a calf, but they're like, Sylvia, this is not a calf. This is a baby elephant, you know? Right. And so I spent the whole week out there. And when I was out there, I sat there and I thought, why don't I write a story about them? And the elephant's name is Molelo, his name. And that means of fire in Swahili. And so So anyways, that's the beginning of how the Environmental Heroes series started. You know, we went ahead and wrote that story together. The little baby elephant was flown into, you know, a town called Kasani, where they had their elephant camp and or an elephant orphanage. And that kind of started things out, you know. And so that was, and so then I started thinking, you know, maybe I can really make a difference with, you know, these storylines about real animals, real conservation groups, and, you know, work with them and see what I can do. And so that's how the idea developed in the first place.
Yeah, because you have such a, there is a wide range here. I mean, we're looking at the environmental stories, or I'm looking at it on the website. And, you know, you have, there's one on, there's lions. We have, I think there's a rhino in there, Caballo, I hope I'm saying that right. The Brave Bees, Grizzly 399, which yeah, I know you have three books on Grizzly 399. What's the process for you when you look at this? Because now that you have this structure in place, what's the process for you for picking the animal, picking the environmental cause, and then marrying those two together or those three things together and getting a story out of it? So how did, you know, once you did the first one and then you move forward and you do the rest of these environmental stories. So let's just pick, you know, Grizzly 399, like with that one's over the course of three books, which is really good. I mean, I read through them after you gave them to us at the summit. What's the storyline? How do you hit that? Where does all the creativity come from, I guess?
Well, I think with 399 specifically, well, I live in Idaho Falls, so I live an hour and a half from Teton National Park. And after I sold my business, I had more time to go up to the parks, you know. And so, you know, I go up there and I heard about this grizzly bear all the time, you know. And I also know, I knew of Tom Engelson, but I didn't know him that well. And so I started pestering him because I was looking at all the different images that he was making. So I'm specifically hitting about 399. So,
right.
And you know, he, and I just saw the different, you know, images he had in his studio of her. And so I started pestering him and asking him if he'd do a book with me about 399. And so for 2 years, he kind of said no. And so finally, I had Dana, who works for him. I said, can you ask him again? So one evening about 10 o'clock at night, I got a call from him and he says, yeah, I'll do it with you. And so, and it was interesting because, you know, the favorite way I like to do write a book is if somebody tells me the story. This is the story I want you to write, you know, then I can kind of start writing it. Instead, he hands me his $3.99 book and says, here, read it and tell me what you're going to write, you know, how it's going to come out. So I read the whole Pilgrims of the Grizzly Bears of Pilgrim Creek. Big book. I had to, you know, redline it. And then I came up with an idea, you know, and then I sent it over to him and I said, well, what do you think of this? And he goes, that'll work, you know? And so we took it and then, you know, we do a storyboard, we write it out. And it was really about how Grizzly 399 came to, you know, of course I had to take some creative liberties of how did 399 come to the park? I mean, you have to assume she was born in Yellowstone and maybe she migrated over. Those are some things that, you know, some of it might be made up because really we don't know what happens to a baby grizzly when it's little, you know, or its mother. So we take some creative liberty in writing some of the storyline. And then, and when I did that book, you know, she was Grizzly 399 was barely really starting to get famous, you know? And so we wrote that first book and it really kind of involved how Tom follows her and how, you know, he kind of helped to get people to know her. And then the second book we did about just hibernation, you know, which is, it was just a cute book. It was just funny because you look at little kids and you're trying to get children to want to read a book. Okay. And, you know, if they're sitting there like laughing about certain things, you know, so I kind of made it humorous about what would it be like to have five grizzlies that are growing in, you know, a den, you know, that would be horrible. You know, I mean, you can't even move and somebody's making some bad smells that they're not supposed to, you know, stuff like that. And little kids just, you know, get really love that kind of stuff. So we kind of wrote that one just because it was fun. And then we did the four cubs book. And that was when she had her four cubs. And just the issues that surrounded, you know, people actually habituating grizzlies, habituating bears. And then during that period of time when we wrote the book, there are, I don't even know, 30 to 50 bears that got euthanized by the Fish and Game Department. I think maybe it was Wyoming Fish and Game Department or the park. I'm not even, I have to go back and look at that. But it was just kind of really sad because this is what people have done to these animals by, you know, feeding them, and they shouldn't do that. So the book was specifically to teach children to tell their parents, hey, you shouldn't be doing this, you know? And, you know, that's the year that 399 went into town with her cubs. I don't know if you guys know, she actually physically walked in downtown Jackson at night in the evening with four cubs that were like almost 2 years old, huge animals downtown. And, you know, and they were lucky that nobody ran into five huge grizzly bears.
Yeah.
So that's kind of, you know, what the stories are about, is what can we do to, you know, stop some of the activities, that the bad habits and things that we're doing that are destroying these animals, you know, because they're learning bad habits, you know?
Yeah. Right.
So that's kind of what happened with the 399 book. So essentially what I do is, you know, I identify, so I spoke about 399, but, you know, sometimes I'll get a call from somebody and says, hey, we'd like you to consider writing a book for us these days. You know, I just got a call from Oceanwise. They want to do a book on, you know, an animal, maybe a shark or something. I got a call from a cheetah organization based out of the UK. They wanted a cheetah conservation group. They're talking to me about doing a book in about 6 months. And right now we have another book that's coming out pretty soon that I'm working on orcas. But I do get calls, and then periodically I just see a story and I'm like, I want to know more about it, you know? And so, like, we did a book with a woman called Lek Chilart from Save Elephant Foundation, based out of Thailand. And I saw her and I was just really touched by her story and what she's done. And so I flew myself to Thailand and met her. And we came up with the story, you know, documenting how she became who she is and what she's done. So
what is it about your personality, or I don't want to put words in your mouth, but why do you think you're the type of person who can write kids books? I mean, not everyone can. I mean, many people can think of stories, but I think kids books are kind of a very specific art form. I mean, what is it about stories for kids that speaks to you and feels like a natural art form, if it does?
Well, you know, I have three children, you know, I have twins that are 17 now, you know, and a little boy that's 14. And so, you know, you sit in a car and you hear them talk, you know, and as an engineer, like I said, and you know, I'm kind of making fun of it, but you know, when you actually get an engineering degree, you don't take classes, that many classes in English or anything. You're like, right, take one course in writing or something, and that's it. And the rest are like in electrical engineering and fluid dynamics and thermal analysis and all this stuff, you know? And so you take engineering classes. And so for the most part, I would say most engineers aren't good writers. I mean, for like a children's book like that, you know? And so when I first wrote the first books, I have to admit, I think I did a really poor job, you know? And then, you know, I started kind of looking at it, and I also volunteered as a librarian for my kids' school because they didn't have one. And so I started looking at all the books that the kids were reading and what they liked. And I started kind of, you know, picking up, you know, the nuances of how to write stories. And I'm still learning it, to be honest with you, you know, because it differs for different age groups. And I'm not sometimes I think I'm still not the best writer, but, you know, after a few runs through a story, I'm like, I can pick out, okay, this is going to be good for the kids, you know? And right now, to be honest with you, I'm working with some co-authors on these books, not Doug, but, you know, some of the other folks, you know, on different books, and their writing is just too advanced for kids. And so, you know, I have to bring it down and say, no, this is how a kid talks, not like this, you know? And so I have learned a lot and I'm still learning, Stephen. So did that answer your question?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I think coming from also, I would imagine the way your brain works in an engineering sense, that's a interesting comment you just made, is that you're the one that's taking the language from people who are helping you, or like you were getting ideas for authoring these books, and you have to bring it down to a child's levels. Cause I can't imagine, I'm wondering how that works for you in your brain, because it's probably technical, and I don't want to put words in your mouth either, but being an engineer, I'm sure there's a lot of different processes going on inside of your brain, as opposed to, like you say, bringing it down to a child's level, reading level, and a story level in that way. Do you find that as a, does that help or hurt you when you're going through these things?
Well, it's kind of funny that you say that, because, you know, the thing is that, you know, I'm also of Hispanic Mexican descent. Okay. So, you know, we're third generation, but I learned my first language was Spanish, and I only knew Spanish till I was five. And so, you know, and then actually I didn't even know how to speak Spanish after many years, you know, because I went to school, but my parents spoke, you know, very broken English for a while. Their English wasn't that great. So, you know, I already kind of grew up with, you know, language that wasn't as technical. So for me to go from being where I was to becoming an engineer and then learning that language and then coming back, actually, it hasn't been that hard, because that's how I originated, actually. So, and then I have three kids, you know, I hear them talking and but some of the stuff they say these days, I don't know, I can't repeat them. So, anyways, what do you think?
Yeah.
That's kind of.
No, it's like I said, it's a very fascinating circle that you've made, because again, like you, it's great. I didn't know about your upbringing and the heritage aspect of it. And that's a way, obviously, you're tapping back into the way that you were growing up in your younger years. And then just, it's almost though you're accessing a different part of your brain and a memory there of, oh, I had to do this, you know, as I was growing up from ages, whatever it was, five to, you know, your formative years. And then just circling back to that. I think to me, that's very interesting, because you're able to recall that stuff and to be able to facilitate it into something, building this children's book library that you're building, mm-hmm. is really tremendous to be able to do that, coming from the scientific background that you come from. When you go through all this, I guess what's the, and we'll get to the wolf books in just a moment, because that's the thing that we want to, we'll get to that in just a moment. But when you're putting these stories together, what's the ultimate goal for the readers that you know are going to be picking up these books? Is there a specific intention? Are you hoping that the story ropes them into the issue that's at hand, or vice versa? Or like you said, sometimes just making a book that is interesting and fun to get a young child to want to learn more about grizzlies, learn more about rhinos, whatever the animal may be.
Well, it's kind of the one thing that you look at the books that I've written. You know, well, first of all, I have a few illustrators that are really good. One's Morgan Spicer, and she did the $3.99 books and quite a few of the other books. And then I was able to, it was really, you know, Andreas Wessel Thurhorn. He's a Disney artist, and he came on and he did Tarzan and Princess and the Frog. And so he's very talented. You know, you kind of look at the different, you know, and I just brought up the art, because the art, of course, has to bring the kids into the stories. But one of the things that Andreas told me is, like, you know, Sylvia, he says, can we get a story that's a little lighter? You know, I mean, like, and what he meant was, you know, you look at the different, like, the stories that we've done, you know, it's just, and the issues that we try and tackle through these books. Like, if you look at, like, the rhino books, well, rhinos are getting poached, you know. You look at blood lions, I mean, blood lions, they're raising lions to be canned, you know, for canned hunts. And how do you make a difficult story, I mean, a story about these animals that have to end up maybe being poached or go into a canned lion hunt? How do you make that into a story that's not just really frightening for a child, as well, yeah, and yet teach them the importance of what you're trying to teach them? And so it's, you know, I really kind of really think about that, you know, when we're writing the stories. You know, when we did the work, the book on blood lions, that one was very hard, because the lions at the end of, you know, going through these petting, you know, like sanctuaries supposedly, and then they end up in a canned hunt. How do you write a story about a lion that's going to end up getting killed, like, by that situation? And so, right, you know, me and Ian Mitchler, and he was in the movie of Blood Lions, he's my co-author, we kind of talked about it. He would Zoom me from South Africa, And we'd sit there and talk, now, how do we write a story that's going to embrace children, yet not scare them and make them want to make a difference and tell their parents, hey, we can't go pet those cubs because this is what's going to happen to them. And so, so some stories, yeah, they're lighter, but at the end of the day, you got a very, very difficult, you know, subject to tackle for these stories. So that's, yeah, that's the similarity between most of the stories, and it's kind of hard. So,
yeah. Yeah. I mean, do you ever deal with, on this topic of kind of like what to tell kids and what not to tell them and what they can handle emotionally and what they can't handle emotionally, and also what's important to tell them. Do you ever deal with criticism about, because a lot of writers do, right? A lot of writers that we've spoken to as well, criticism just about softening the stories too much or anthropomorphizing animals and things of that nature, sort of like the science brain versus the storytelling brain. Sometimes these types of personalities collide over topics like this.
Well, I think what's interesting when you bring that up is we do anthropomorphize the animals. And, you know, of course, little kids, I mean, if you watch Bambi, they anthropomorphize the whole thing, you know, it's like the movie Bambi, you know, and or Lion King or something, you know, animals, you know, and personally, I believe animals have emotions, and I believe that animals do smile at each other and they do these things. Right. The thing that we do have, so when you ask about, you know, do people think that we're too hard or too soft on our approach? We haven't had too much of that where they don't like the way we wrote the story. We have had very little of that. But when the storyline itself. But we have been like 399 books. Here's an example. We can't get them into the national parks because the national park, or at least Yellowstone, or at least Teton National Park, even though 399 lives in Teton, because they want our books to be non-anthropomorphized. And that's a topic, you know, that, you know, you look at, like, Jane Goodall believes in anthropomorphizing animals. She believes that animals do communicate with each other the way we sometimes write it, you know? And so that is a criticism I have received, is that, you know, and so when we get to the wolf books, we are going to have a version that's anthropomorphized versus non, so that we can try to get them into the parks. And so that's kind of, to me, I think that somebody, you know, needs to really assess that and determine, well, animals do communicate in a certain way, you know? I mean, if you look at, you know, elephants, you see the things where elephants, where they mourn. Wolves mourn. I mean, when they lose a baby, how can you say that there's no, that's not there? So anyways, but that is the criticism we have received, so.
Just trying to get those things into the national parks, you would think that's an interesting roadblock to a degree to get to there. So since you spoke about it, you actually have two wolf books that are coming down the pike, which is pretty exciting. What's the angle that you're tackling? So we'll do the first one, which I believe is called The White Wolves of Yellowstone, right, Sylvia?
Yes.
And so this is highlighting Canyon and her daughter from the Wapiti Pack. So what's the angle that you're going to, in order, well, tell us, I guess, initially about the story, and then how you're trying to have one side
it's a hard word
it's a hard word to say, that where the two different versions of the book that you're trying to make sure you have one in the national park, one that's allowed in the national parks, I guess, or able to be in the national parks.
Well, we're hoping. So, first of all, I didn't, you know, I'm like a grizzly person, you know, I like grizzlies a lot. So I go up to Tetons, and I'm a bloomy photographer. I hope I have a Canon R5, you know, and I'm learning how to take photos with it. So I'm really excited about it. So I run up there as much as I can. I try not to become part of the crazy pack of people following them. I just by try and get photos if I can, you know. But you know, I had interest in wolves, but not a lot, you know. I mean, I like wolves, I think it's really cool. But I met a woman named Renee Hersey from and she'd read Grizzly 399. She called me. She says, well, want to see if you know, what do you think about a wolf book? I'm like, well, I guess I could look at a wolf book, you know. you know, I'm thinking about it because I live close to Yellowstone. So then I get an invitation to go to the Wolf Conference in Gardner. And I get the invitation, you know, I mean, you know, she sends it, so you better apply, you know, and I didn't apply on time. And I'm like, oh, Renee, I can't go. And she's like, well, I'm going to get you in. So she, and then she, in the meantime, she introduced me to Julie Argyle, who's a big photographer of wolves. And they got me into, you know, Kim Bean got me in and said, no, you're coming. So I went thinking I'm going to go for one day to the conference. And then I'm going to sneak out. I'm going to go look for grizzly bears and take pictures of bears, you know. So, you know, so I brought all my stuff, you know, and I'll just come to a few talks, you know. That was my plan. And so I get there. And of course, I didn't tell Renee that or Kim or anybody, but I was going to go do that. And I went with Green. Kristen Combs was also there, you know. So I get there and I just start listening to the talks. And it just pulled me in. I was like just mesmerized. And so one day I ended up being there the whole time, the entire time. And so then I, you know, was listening to Doug talk, and I'd seen some of his stuff before as well, Doug Smith. And I also had gotten to know Rick McIntyre before. I had tried to meet with him before and said, hey, maybe we could do a book together. And he just, with his current publishing, you know, he's publishing children's books or books himself, he could not work with me because he was already kind of called for. But I got to know Rick. And so when I went over there, you know, I just, you know, met these people and decided I'm going to see if I can write some books, you know. And I talked to Doug and he was very excited to work with me. And I talked with Julie and also with Renee, and those two, especially Julie, has this big love affair with the Wapitis, you know, and so does Renee for that matter. I never heard of them. Didn't know anything about them. And, you know, and so I said, okay, we'll just do two at the same time, because I'd made a commitment also, I'd work with Doug. And so I started learning about the white wolves of Yellowstone. I started finding out about them. And frankly, at first I was really confused because it was, you know, and Canyon is actually, they also, she's also known as the White Lady of Yellowstone. And she's got, and we called her Canyon because, you know, she was part of the Canyon area pack. But I learned all about, you know, them and just the different, you know, because, you know, their genetic line goes from wolf, white wolf to white wolf to white wolf, and they're all matriarchs, you know, they're all leaders of their pack, they're alpha females. And it was just really, really interesting to find out about that specific gene and how, you know, every wolf moves on to the next. And then, and right now, I went to Yellowstone like 2 weeks ago, when a big old snowstorm came in, and I was able to see the new white female, or she's turning white. And it was really exciting. But what we're trying to get out is teach people and children. And I think people who go to Yellowstone, a lot of them want to see the wolves. I mean, that's their whole intent. But little do they know that what happens to some of the wolves when they leave the park. You know, they're naturally trying to, you know, go out and, you know, go look for other, you know, a mate or something. And then they leave the park and then they get killed, you know. And so the story is, you know, does highlight what happens to the wolves, that, you know, that Canyon got killed when she left the park, you know, and then, you know, what happened to her daughter, Queen Wapiti. We call her Queen Wapiti, you know, what happened to her, you know. And and so we're trying to bring educate the kids that maybe they can help, maybe be able to, you know, teach people about what happens when the wolves leave the park. Is there anything we can do? Can we change legislation to protect them? And not just the wolves that leave the park, but other wolves, you know. So that's the story. And, you know, we do have a science section that's going into it right now, working on that as well, getting real images. But it is a tough story, to be honest with you. It's not, you know, at the end, you know, I make it that the wolves are in heaven, you know, and they're looking down and look at the park that they were at, you know, trying to put a good end to the story so that the kids don't lose hope when you read a story. You know, I always try to leave the kids with hope when you have a hard story, you know, and so that's what I hope we did successfully, you know.
It's like you say, you have a difficult angle to try and hit, especially when a lot of these species, a lot of these animals that were, that you're specifically working with or talking about in storytelling to bring it around to, like you say, a positive note or some sort of hope for change in a way that their death wasn't in vain or anything to that degree. Is it the same thing that you were grappled with the book that you're co-authoring with Doug, The Wolf 07, Wolf 09? Is there a connection between the two books? Are they two separate books? I think this one is Matriarchs of Yellowstone. Did you run into the same issues? What was the process like for that one as well?
Yeah,
and really quick, we are working with Wolves of the Rockies on The White Wolves of Yellowstone, just to let you know.
Oh, cool. That's great. Shout out to Mark, Kim, and everybody there at Wolves of the Rockies.
So it's
great.
So it's been really good, and then we're going to give some of our proceeds to them and also Trap Free Montana. So
great.
But with the book we're co-authoring with Doug, or I am, you know, he said, well, Sylvia, you really can't write a story about a wolf until you know what happened, how it started. You know, so then I kind of, you know, of course, I researched all the different children's books that are out there about this subject. And, you know, they're nothing like what I write. They don't look anything like my books. And so, you know, we did a Zoom call. You know, Doug just told me the story of what happened, you know, and we did a couple of Zoom calls. You know, how, you know, they brought the wolves in from Canada, how he was involved, and just the entire story. And he said, you know, Wolf 7 and Wolf 9 were some of the wolves, the main wolves that first came in. And they're part of the Rose Creek pack and also the Leopold pack, you know, that were the originators of the packs. And so, you know, so his point was, we should really tell the kids, this is how it all started again after we did all this. And so when him and I went through it, it is different because we ended up going into like all the Leopold and how, you know, the words that he said about the fierce green fire dies, you know, we went into what happened with the wolves getting completely exterminated by people in the early like 20s. So we actually went back in time. And we talked about how there were all these wolves here. And well, actually, it starts with this one lone wolf in Yellowstone, and there's nobody left except him because everybody's gone. And then we go from there to, you know, what happened in history. So Andreas was, we were working at trying to bring in, you know, people signing the Endangered Species Act. What did it look like? You know, I didn't know that Nixon signed it in. I was like, wow, he signed it in. And, you know, the feelings of the natives, how the natives love the wolf and how they see them as part of, you know, their, you know, they as their brother, you know, pretty much. We brought all that stuff into the story. So it goes into that, it goes into the Endangered Species Act, then it goes into actually identifying the wolves, bringing them in. And so the book is like, with the science section, it's going to probably be about 56 pages. And then we go from there, and then, you know, where we actually go and bring the wolves and into, go to Canada, bring them here. And, you know, Doug brought up things like, well, Sylvia, this was really controversial, what we did here versus this. What do you think about that? And I'm like, well, we don't have to always bring all that stuff. And this is a children's book. This is how it evolved. But we were very right on in terms of truth. He taught me a lot about wolves, you know, about the pack mentality and, you know, and that they like the cold weather. The wolves love the cold weather. I'm like, you know, and so anyway, so it went into Wolf 7 and 9. 9 is the mother who came in, and 7 was a daughter who came in from Canada, and how they ended up, you know, being acclimated with Wolf 10. And Wolf 10 is the wolf, the first wolf that, well, he's the one who got first poached. He's the one who got poached in up in Red Lodge. And so it hits on, this is the first wolf that was poached. And that was kind of hard. So then again, it goes into the same kind of thing that happens with the White Wolves of Yellowstone. The wolf gets poached. And then you got Wolf 9, where she's, you know, that's her daughter. And she ends up really helping to establish, you know, well, both of them helping to establish the main genetics of all the Yellowstone wolves, you know, that they were one of the main, you know, wolves that brought that in. So that's kind of the storyline. I mean, it's and it's important, I think, to know, well, why did the parks bring them in the first place? You know, why did they come from Canada? Why are the wolves come, you know? And so those are, I think, the kids would now know why they have these wolves here, you know. So that was the basis of why we did it. So that's a long answer. So
it's okay. I think it's important because the Wolf 10 is poached, but I think what's different, at least from what you're telling me about Wolf 7 and Wolf 9, is that this is almost a rebirth story, which is actually, again, when you talk about hope and things of that sort, all this terrible stuff happened prior to this reintroduction, and now this is sort of the rebirth of that, or trying to restore something that was already here. So that could be a different angle, maybe, that hopefully the kids take out of it.
That should do good to right our wrongs.
And to change some of the stuff that happens there. Well, I guess the thing that we want to know too is that when are both of these stories going to be ready? Because I'm sure there'll be a lot of after people hear this, or they know if they're fans of Green Kids Club already, and they notice that there's Wolf books coming, that'll be a pretty cool thing. So when are these going to hit the shelves or hit Amazon? Where are people going to be able to find them, and where and when are they going to be able to find them, I guess is the question.
Well, the plan is to have them, ready for to hit the stores by end of April. We were trying to do it earlier, but, I did 2 Wolf books simultaneously, and so that kind of really worked me over. And then they'll be in Amazon. They'll be on our homepage. We're talking to different, retail stores in Yellowstone area and, in Teton area to get them in. And like I mentioned, we're going to do an anthropomorphized version and a non-anthropomorphized version. So the non-anthropomorphized version, we plan to get in front of the committee who reviews the books at the park within the next several weeks, sometime soon. And hopefully we'll get them in the parks as well, because they'll get accepted. So we're looking like end of April, early May. So
that's great. I mean, that's good. Springtime is good. What's the, if you can answer this, what's the process? Is it simply just, we're talking about the board, I guess, to get the books into the parks, or, to be shown in the parks? Is it just a simple, they read the book and they make, is it an opinion-based vote about it, or is there something a little bit more that goes on with that?
I really don't, to be honest with you, I really don't know. But I do know that Doug Smith knows. So, I'm gonna, hit him pretty, of course, he helped co-author one of them. So I think he'll know what the rules are, and he'll say, well, this isn't gonna work. You can't have the wolf smiling here, Sylvia, or flashing her eyelashes at the other wolf. That's just not gonna be okay, So, so when we come to like illustrations like that, we'll bring them down so that it looks a certain way. It looks more like a serious wolf versus a flirty wolf, for example. And then, so I'm assuming, Doug told me that he could probably work with us and help us get through that as a hope. It's not a for sure thing, but I do know that they meet periodically. The committee does. That's all I know about it.
Okay.
Well,
you have my vote for getting them in there. I think these are valuable. This is important stuff. I think that we want all younger kids or younger generations to see the things that, have happened prior to them, and understand that we're trying to do better as much as we can, and inform as much as possible. What is in the future for Green Kids Club? I know you have the 2 Wolf books. Those are coming out simultaneously. I'm sure you're not going to do 2 books at once again, but what's in the next few months, the next 6 months, the next year for Green Kids Club and Sylvia Medina?
Well, the thought is, well, first of all, I probably want to slow down just a little bit, because I'm a little tired, but I do like it. I don't really get paid to do this. And we're a for-profit company that doesn't make a lot, but hopefully we'll get there. We're trying to, at some point in time, get it into animation, these stories. So, we have been going to something called Kids Green, trying to promote the Environmental Heroes series books with maybe like Nat Geo or Discovery. We have plenty of stories, and part of our proceeds can go to these nonprofit groups and see what we can do to make a difference. So that would be something I would love to see. But in the meantime, I'd like to do a book, because we just finished a book called Learning About Grizzlies, which we still need to do a press release. on, and it's just, you know, learning about grizzly bears, you know, it's like, you know, their habits. And so I think I'd like to do one learning about wolves that would can maybe go with this book. And then also I've been asked to do a book on, I'm working actually with a producer named Phil Faircloth, and he's the one who did a Grizzly Man. He produced Grizzly Man and Rhino Wars. And so we're writing a book on, it's called Scully, about the orca that died at Miami Sea Aquarium.
Okay.
So that one's about, we'll try and finish that up in the next, probably by June or July. And then, I did get contacted by a few groups to look at a cheetah book and also an ocean type, maybe a book on sharks. And somebody asked me to do a book on horses, wild horses. So everybody has an idea, but it takes a lot of work. It's a lot of work. I think people think, well, it's a children's book, but we have to, you know, develop the storyline, you know, work with people which organizations we're working with, and then do the illustrations. And it's just, but I'm really happy with the way they're looking these days and how they're coming out. So
yeah, they look great.
We're also working on trying to get our marketing arm a little stronger. You know, being in Idaho Falls, when you don't live in New York or California or something, you know, it's a little hard to get us out there and get us known, because, you know, when you live there, you go to these conferences, get to know people. And when you're here, you know, it's not that easy. So we're pushing that pretty well. We're going to go to the licensing conference in Las Vegas and see where we can to get
it's
our
a lot of work.
Brand recognition. So,
yep, a lot of work.
Yeah. It's always the thing to get your name out there. I mean, hopefully we can help as much as we can. Obviously anybody who's listening to this that. And we'll share some of the pages and stuff like that. My two more things. The one, I don't think I even asked in the beginning. When you partner with these conservation, or you partner with the groups, whatever it is, you said some of the proceeds, are all of the proceeds or most of the proceeds going towards, like you were saying, you're working with Wolves of the Rockies on the White Wolves of Yellowstone. Is that how it happens with any of the stories, you know, with the elephant rescue, when you were talking about Malolo, the fire elephant, do the profits of the book, whatever it is, go towards the sanctuary, or go towards the preserve, or whatever it is that you acquired or you got the story from? Is that typically how it works?
Yeah, if you look at nonprofits, you know, typically, like if somebody does something, they'll donate like 5% or something, you know. Mm-hmm. We donate somewhere between 10 to 30% of our proceeds, but that really makes us a nonprofit company, you know. And so, which means that, you know, we absorb all the costs, because illustrating a book, you know, costs about $10,000. You know, and then to get editors and everybody involved, you know, you're looking at, you know, those are just some really low costs, actually. If somebody wanted to go in and publish a book, it's probably about $36,000 to $40,000 just for self-publishing. But, you know, so it does it. So I'm hoping at some point in time, a lot of times I donate part of it or more of, you know, what it costs to produce a book. Sometimes I do the whole thing just because I want to make a difference, really make a difference. But, you know, so normally, so like just right now, we don't call them royalties. We just call them donations. At the end of each year, we'll go ahead and give them anywhere from 10 to 30% of our proceeds. We figure out how much we've sold. We send them a check, and that's how we do it. And also, you know, we also come up with an agreement, how it'll work. I usually give them 1 to 200 softback books so that they can do anything they want with them. And, you know, try and promote them on social media and, you know, do what we can. So that's our approach.
That's great. No, that's good. Anything giving back is something. And listen, anybody who's listening, we're going to have Green Kids Club website where you can get these real, I mean, really the books are really beautiful. The illustrations are great. The stories are great. The cause is great. And so we will have all that information and obviously get ready for those wolf books that are coming out. In short order. So anybody who's listening to this, they'll be ready to purchase soon. Sylvia, my last question for you is, when you hear the word wolf, what's the thing that comes to your mind?
Well, seeing that I was in Yellowstone 3 weeks ago, it was really crazy, because we got a snow coach at the last minute, me and Renee and her partner and or Ellen. And we just decided to go, you know, let's just go. And it did cost money, you know, but we thought we've got to go in there. And I hadn't seen the wapitis, you know? And so we started going in, we went through Gardner and then we got over to Madison area, and And our snow coach guide, his name's Gypsy. He's like, let's go back and forth. Like, he goes, I think the wolves are here around here somewhere. So we rode back and forth for like 5 hours. And then I'm you know, I'm Catholic. So I started praying, oh God, please let us see the wolves, you know? And I go to Africa periodically and I can hear in my voice, my head voice, oh, there they are. Like with the lions, there they are. And then just a few minutes later, I heard, oh, there they are. And we saw all 13 of the wapitis looking straight at us. And we were all alone. There was nobody else but us because we were living in that part of the. So right now, when you say, what do I picture? I picture the wapitis all looking at me. It was fantastic. And nobody else but us out there.
That's a fantastic moment. It really is. Sylvie Medina, again, thank you for what you're trying to do to promote all this information, this conservation for the next generation to make them informed. It's beautiful. So thank you for everything you do and you're going to continue to do. Thanks for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you guys interviewing me. So thank
you. Of course. Just stick with us for a minute while we sign off. How's to y'all out there and we'll be with you next time. Bye everybody. Looking for more information about Wolf Connection or the podcast? Please visit our website at wolfconnection.org where you can donate, sponsor a wolf, or become a volunteer.